Welcome to Political Rewind. We have a great panel here to talk about politics today. Some of it's state politics, but we'll also touch on national politics and President Trump as the hour proceeds. Greg Bluestein, political reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. It's Wednesday. You're back with us. Thank you for being here, Greg.
Glad to be back.
Are you already working on something for tomorrow's paper? Well, what will we see your byline attached to?
You will see a story on the mayor's race and the hunt for endorsements and really a broader story about how, despite big names getting behind mayoral candidates, it still hasn't really crystallized the race yet. There's a real big fight for number two in that race right now.
Okay, we're going to talk about that a little bit. Kyle Wingfield from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution is here as well. You read his column on Thursdays and Sundays in the AJC. That means you have either filed or are about to file for tomorrow. You want to give us a preview?
It's already in, and it's about politicizing these gun tragedies.
We're definitely going to talk about that. And Theron Johnson, we're so glad that you're back, Theron, Democratic political consultant who's been involved in races across the board from city and state races all the way up to presidential. He was President Obama's campaign, Southern campaign chairman during the 2012 race. Chairman's the wrong word. Director, I think. Right, Theron?
That's correct.
Thank you. How are you doing?
I'm doing fantastically well. I mean, to be in a room with so many great reporters and journalists, I don't know what to do with myself.
You're surrounded.
Yeah.
Just a couple of quick headlines. President Trump has landed. He landed about an hour ago in Las Vegas and is making a visit to the hospital where so many of the victims of that awful shooting on Sunday evening are being treated. That's a closed session, but we do expect at some point the president will come out and have something to say. The reporters who are traveling with him have reported that he has been advised to stay very strictly on script, which is not something that happened when he was in Puerto Rico yesterday. And we're going to talk a little bit about that as we move forward, too. But you know what? Hey, let's start with that mayor's race real quickly. You know, again, we know we have a statewide audience, but I think people across the state are watching the mayor's race because in the long run, the mayor of Atlanta has an impact on the entire state.
And could be the most prominent Democratic official in the state as well, depending on 2018 and depending on who wins next year.
Okay, fair enough. So there's a new poll. Channel 11 uses Surveys USA that shows that Mary Norwood remains out front by a fairly substantial margin. But Keisha Lance Bottoms has moved up in the pack. And a couple of the other people, like Peter Amon and other, there seems to be some drop off there. Now, so here's my first question. Greg, and I'll let everybody have a shot at this. Isn't it important to say right away that when you're talking about a voting pool of maybe 80,000 people, that any attempt to poll voters is going to be really tricky and not necessarily substantive, no matter how good a polling organization might be?
Yes, and there also has been scant public polls. There's only been a few different polls out there, and sometimes they're months apart. And all of them show that Mary Norwood's hovering around the 30% mark. But this, the hunt for number two in a likely December runoff has been really, really crowded. What the last few polls have shown is that Keisha Lance Bottoms, the city councilwoman, is moving up. There's questions about the methodology of this poll that some of the other candidates raised, that it too heavily weights African-American voters over white voters in this race. But either way, even if you rebalance the way it's weighted, she's still moving up. She still looks like she's got a decent chance at getting that number two spot. But there is still a very crowded field of five or six other candidates within striking distance.
Who is she, Theron?
You know, Keisha Lance Bottoms is someone who ran unsuccessfully back in 2008 for Fulton County Superior Court judge. I mean, she was a magistrate court judge for a while. She went to law school and went to undergrad at FAMU. And I can't remember exactly where she went to law school. I think it was either Georgia State or University of Georgia. But honestly, Bill, she's been someone who's represented the most affluent African-American district in the city. And quite frankly, I think what you see with this sort of surge is that she has strategically been targeting voters, particularly likely voters, all around the city for some time now through her council office, but more importantly, through her campaign. And what we're seeing is Kasim Reed, Lisa Borders, and Mary Norwood and Jesse Spites kind of all over again. But it's kind of reverse effect. 8 years ago, I went back and looked at my emails. Kasim Reed and I were questioning Matt Towery, who was doing the polling at that time for WSB. And we were questioning the formula of it, because what a public poll does, it can either help you or hurt you as far as momentum. So if you're Mary Norwood right now, you are still feeling pretty good about where you are. I mean, she knows that unless she just does something unethical or stupid, she's going to be in a runoff. But for Keisha, Bill, this now puts her out there where donors in particular, they're saying, oh, my God, let me maybe look at her race a little differently now. But the fact still remains, to Greg's point, and someone who's been in this before, we're still a long way away from Election Day. So there's still people that have a shot to get in this runoff. But Keisha definitely, with public polling and private polling that I've been privy to, has definitely had some increased numbers, and as well as Peter Amon and Cesar Mitra as well.
Yeah, Kyle, this race is really interesting, because it strikes me that the reality is there are any number of really strong candidates in this field. I'm not going to name who I think they are, but I think most people generally agree there are probably four or so candidates, all of whom would probably make anywhere from serviceable to really excellent mayors. And that's what people around the city are saying. They ask me all the time, who should I vote for? My answer, I don't know. But they all feel this way.
Well, and to put it another way, there's probably six or seven still who think they have a shot at that second place spot. And if I'm anyone in that race other than Mary Norwood, I don't think I feel very comfortable about this at all. I think what Theron was saying about a month to go, still a long way to go. If we get more frequent polling, or you know, if we get to, or some of us reporters get to see some of that private polling, it'd be really interesting to see what that fluctuation looks like over time. But clearly, from where I sit, it looks like to me what Keisha Lance Bottoms is benefiting the most from is the attention that the mayor's been giving her and putting behind her.
The magic word, the mayor. we'll let Greg, I'm going to let you talk about this before we give Theron a chance to talk about his friend, the mayor. But Kasim Reed has not exactly been silent, either for or against candidates in this race.
No, he hasn't. And that was the subject of a longer piece we did in Sunday's paper. There's 13 candidates in the race, and there's about three of them he's been a little bit more supportive of the others. He has been very, very vocal about Vincent Fort and Kathy Woolard.
He called them
Wile E. Coyote. Yeah. That he'll never win. I mean, he's used some pretty harsh rhetoric about some of these candidates. But Mary Norwood, Keisha Lance Bottoms and Peter Amon and Kwanzaa Hall, he's been a little bit more friendly to, especially Keisha. She has been at some of his behind him in some of his press conferences and some of his events. So she might be benefiting from some of that. And the other thing she might be benefiting from is this is a very crowded field, but she's the only African-American female in the race. And black women make up the largest part of the state Democratic electorate and the city's Democratic electorate.
Theron, the mayor, pilloried Cesar Mitchell, president of the city council running for the job, when Cesar said, maybe with this looming scandal, which has already begun unfolding about purchasing, we ought to stop doing any new purchasing until after the new mayor comes in. That was a great opportunity for the mayor to pound him into the ground.
Well, I know a lot of the mayor's people are listening, so let me make sure I say this correctly. The mayor would say that he actually was hit first by Cesar, and then he responded.
Fair enough.
But be that as it may, Bill, what you're seeing is a mayor right now that in this poll that we just mentioned is still roughly at about 60% approval rating. Whether you like how he handles things in the press, the fact of the matter is that the people of the city of Atlanta feels that this mayor is doing a good job. One thing I want to kind of mention, and I think that, you know, we got to give Kwanzaa Hall a big shout out. I mean, he actually had a big day with passing unanimously.
Another city council member.
Yeah, sorry. City council member who's running for mayor, who had a really big day by getting a unanimous vote with a little bit of amendment by a couple people. But, you know, let's not count him out either. I think that Kwanzaa is working very hard. But the one thing I want to pay close attention to for our listeners is next week, Bill, whether I'm on the show or not, you guys are going to be talking about fundraising numbers. Mm-hmm. And what's going to be very particular is to see, number one, how much money does Mary Norwood really have in the bank? Because once she goes on the air, television, radio, does she have the ability to stay up throughout the general? But also, I'm hearing a lot of rumors, a lot of rumblings about Keisha Lance Bottoms having a really good quarter. Because Caesar Mitchell has consistently been able to raise a lot of money. And we know that Peter Amon, I mean, he's limitless as far as his ability.
Former Bain consultant, so yeah. He really understands systems and worked with the mayor in City Hall, of course.
And worked with me. We came in together. Okay. There's a great picture of us in AJC on the first day. But Peter has put a lot of his personal money in. And I think will come out showing that he has probably spent the most money, definitely spent the most of his personal money. And then lastly, Kathy Wooler. I mean, if you look at these forums, what I'm hearing that Kathy Wooler is getting better and better. She went after Peter Amon, the former COO of Mayor Reed, for this corruption guilty plea from Adam Smith and kind of trying to wrap that around him. So, again, to Kyle's point, this thing is far from over.
Kyle, Kwanzaa Hall won the stoner vote going away the other day by leading the charge to pass legislation that dramatically reduced the penalties for marijuana possession of under an ounce in the city of Atlanta. The Atlanta's police chief was quick to say, no, it isn't decriminalized. It's just we still will enforce the law. It's just the council has changed how the courts can punish.
Right. And you know, call me a cynic. I thought this was the ultimate in election campaign theatrics. And I understand he's been
interested in it. But it passed, what, unanimously?
Who's going to vote against it?
Well, I would think a lot of people would want to vote. Do you really think?
A lot of people in the Atlanta City Council, I'd be a little dubious of that.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
But even Buckhead council members voted for it. I was a little surprised it was 15-0. Yeah.
But to me, the tell was the way that Keisha Lance Bottoms and Vincent Fort went after each other on the issue about, well, when he went to speak about it and she said, well, why didn't you do this in the legislature? And they had a back and forth about that. I saw it as a big positioning sort of thing. It is still illegal in the state of Georgia, but.
And it always will
politics,
be if
right?
Sessions has his way.
If we got rid of all the showmanship and politics, what would we have left? Right?
I'll tell you. All right. So the mayor's it is just now that I think we want to begin really taking a much closer look at the Atlanta mayor's race. And so we'll continue to do that in the weeks leading up to that November election. Let's do this. Let's get a break out of the way, because the governor's race, the Democratic side of the race, suddenly got a little more attention, got a little more heated this week, because as we talked about on the show when we had Kathy Cox here on Monday, there was a forum Monday night sponsored by the Georgia Win List, the organization that recruits female Democratic pro-choice candidates to run for office. First time that Stacey Abrams and Stacey Evans have gone head-to-head, and there were some pretty interesting exchanges we'll talk about. But first, let's take a break. This is Political Rewind.
When Hurricane Irma threatened Georgia, GPB News was there.
I guess I feel safe being here because I'm with my family. I'm in the house that I grew up in.
Clothes, important papers, pictures, whatever I could in a compact car. But it's three other people and a baby.
I mean, we have a lot of people that are frankly, tired of natural disasters at this point.
Listen to GPB News. We tell you the whole story, and we stand with the facts.
Welcome back. We have Theron Johnson, Democratic political consultant, Kyle Wingfield, and Greg Bluestein of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution in the studio for today's show. We'll talk about the Stacey's forum, but Kyle, you suggested that before even talking about one forum, what's coming up for the Republicans?
Well, so we're going to talk about the first Democratic forum. The first Republican candidate forum is coming up Saturday morning in Milledgeville. So that will be very interesting to watch and see what goes there.
And there's also a Sunday evening forum in Augusta. So they're kind of doing a double-decker.
So all of this is to say it may only be October, but people sometimes forget the primary is in May.
Right.
Those of us who've been around for a long time remember when primaries were in July, and so this is early for that. But when Georgia moved to May, suddenly the whole calendar got accelerated in a big, big way. Greg, you were there the other night. Just overall, in a general way, how would you assess what you saw? Was this two candidates early on trying to position themselves, get their own, establish who they are out there before they can be attacked by the other? Or are these two people ready to engage?
I think they're ready to engage. I wouldn't call it bitter or fiery, but both of those candidates came poised for a healthy debate. And that's exactly what I think we got.
I should have said, Stacey Evans, state representative.
Former
state representative, with the backing of Roy Barnes, mm-hmm. Among other kind of, I don't know how to describe Roy Barnes, former governor, of course, but representing a Democratic Party that some people think may be hard to reassemble today. Right?
Yeah, she holds to the Roy Barnes sort of strategy of trying to kind of, I guess, a bigger tent, you'd say, trying to mobilize white suburban voters that used to be firmly in the Democratic fold that no longer have steadily fled to the GOP.
And then Stacey Abrams, of course, former minority leader in the state house, African-American, who is looking to build the coalition that Democrats tend to turn to nowadays, right, Theron, which is a large percentage of African-American votes, and with needing some white vote to get over the top.
Yeah, I mean, clearly she's made it very, public that's her strategy. She truly believes that the many decades now, or a couple decades of trying to convince more white voters to vote for a Democrat is not the way to go. She truly believes that if you can motivate people of color, more progressives in the state, that's a pathway to victory for her.
Kyle, one of the big issues, we're going to play just a couple of exchanges so you all out there can get a feel for how this thing unfolded. We remember that this past summer there was a big conference of liberals, some people would say radical lefties, called Netroots Nation, which came to Atlanta, brought people in from all over the country. And Stacey Evans had a spot to speak. She was shouted down. She was, I think, fair to say, treated very poorly. She could not talk at all, despite her best efforts to do so. And it became an issue between Stacey Evans and Stacey Abrams because Abrams refused to say that was wrong, wrong-headed.
Right. It was an ugly episode, and I think anyone outside Team Abrams pretty much recognizes that it was not a good look for any group of people, but especially for two factions of Democrats. I may or may not have written "radical lefties" in my blog write up of the event.
I said that's how some people would characterize them.
I may or may not be some, but. You know, it's one thing to, you hold up signs, you have a couple of stray shouts here and there. I think part of it, and part of the reason that maybe it resonated in a different way than some might have expected, is because it sort of reflects some of what we've seen on college campuses across America throughout this year, too, of left-wing activists refusing to let people who disagree with them at all speak their mind and make their points. And it's one thing if it's Ben Shapiro, who's a right, very conservative commentator, but Stacey Evans is pretty progressive in her own
right. But Greg and Theron, aside from what Kyle says, is probably correct, but we also unfortunately saw here race play a part in this.
The chance was
you were there.
Yeah, I was standing right there. The chance for support black women, trust black women. And as we're about to hear, I bet, this played a role in Monday's forum. But both candidates basically said along the same lines of what they said right after the protest, right after the event.
Let's listen to the exchange and then come back, and everybody should talk about it.
I believe in protest. I think that sometimes for the voiceless, it's the only way they think they'll be heard. And whether it's taking a knee or protesting in a conference or standing up, I will always support the right to protest, but I will never silence my opponent. I will never silence my colleague and I will never silence Stacey Evans.
You might not be surprised to learn
that was
that
Stacey Abrams first. Now you're hearing Stacey Evans. Go ahead. I'm sorry, Tom.
Protests came to be. I certainly support the right to protest. Just as I said in the paper, I think we show our love for this country, our allegiance for this country when we kneel and when we stand. And I support the right of folks to peacefully protest. That wasn't what happened at Netroots. And if something like that had happened to my opponent, whether the group was affiliated, unaffiliated, slightly affiliated, not affiliated at all, I would have stood up and said that it was wrong, because it was wrong.
This is a place where you and I are going to disagree. Protest is disruptive. It's uncomfortable. But for communities that have been silenced, it is sometimes their only way to make themselves heard. I will condemn anyone who turns this into a racial conversation. I will condemn anyone who turns this into a misogynistic conversation. But I will never condemn a person for speaking and for protest, especially at a protest conference. My belief is this. I've enjoyed privileges in this country because of protest. And I may not always agree with the content of the protest or the way it was done. And certainly my campaign had nothing to do with it and would never ask for it. But what I will say is that I do not believe that you silence those who feel that they are voiceless, because the minute we do that, we are no better than those who tell people they can't kneel in protest.
I think we'll continue to disagree about the characterization, but I will just say this. I had a right to be heard on that stage, as did the protesters, and unfortunately, that didn't get to happen because it wasn't a peaceful protest.
That last voice, of course, Stacey Evans. Theron, however you come down on this, this is not good news for the Democratic Party of Georgia to have this kind of fight going on.
Well, yes and no. No, because we do have our top Democratic candidates for governor sort of talking about, as you guys just talked about, I mean, race. But yes, in the fact that, look, I mean, I'm ready to see some fire for both of them, but particularly Stacey Evans. I mean, I've known her for over 17 years, and let me tell you, I know that she can get in the ring and box with anyone, you know, politically. But what you saw is Abrams, being the great counterpuncher that she's displayed while she was in the legislature, really kind of was able to take a delicate balance to the approach. But I want to go back to something that Greg said, and this is where I think the Abrams campaign missed a moment, to your point, Kyle. That whole Netroots organization and protest, when they said defend black women, support black women, this was an ongoing fight that this particular caucus was having with Netroots, because in Netroots, they were not allowing people of color, but particularly women, to actually speak during the meeting, to actually be involved in the process and all the protocol. It was just unfortunate that you had this white Democratic candidate in Stacey Evans who fell prey to this protest organization. And when they shouted, protect black women, support black women, it automatically took it to the tone. So what Abrams was in a very tough position, because this is a group where a lot of these people are going to fundraise for her. A lot of these folks are going to come to Georgia and campaign for her. So she couldn't necessarily condemn them. But I think that there could have been a little bit more time for her to explain. Now, Evans did a wonderful job of saying, listen, I deserve to be heard. It was very courageous of her and the inclusive person that I know that she is to go to that conference where she knew that this was an audience that was not going to necessarily be favorable to her. So I think as we continue to go down this road, I think these two women, either one of them would be a great candidate to go against the Republican nominee for governor.
Greg, how did you feel? Theron made an interesting point. He, knowing Stacey Evans for a long time, but without saying it, suggesting maybe she needs to become a little bit more assertive, or whatever the wording might be. How did that play out Monday night for those of you who were there? In the exchange we heard, it did sound as though Stacey Abrams, just listening to it, was more energized, more present for the conversation. Evan seemed to be holding back as we heard it on the audio. That may not have been what it was like in person.
No, I mean, it was a little bit harder to hear Stacey Evans at parts of it, but I think both candidates, this wasn't sort of a clearing of the air. This wasn't a getting together and getting on the same page at all. This was more of a both candidates sort of dug deeper into their respective positions. And as you heard at the end of that, you heard Stacey Evans chime in. I think this is an area we're going to continue to disagree upon, and I don't think it's an issue that's going away throughout the rest of this campaign.
Let's go on to another issue between them. Greg, you've been doing most of the bulk of the reporting on the governor's race so far. And this has to do with a dispute between the two of them about Stacey Evans' support of Governor Deal's takeover of failing schools. Evans supported that, and Abrams has been going after her for that. You can explain it to us a little better than I did.
Yeah, Stacey Abrams has been on the campaign trail saying her opponent, she's the only Democrat in the race not supporting privatization. That Stacey, you know, alleging that Stacey Evans supports school privatization. And there's actually two issues that she cites. She cites her vote for the Opportunity School District, Governor Nathan Deal's failing schools initiative, that ended up not passing, not passing the constitutional amendment last year. But also she cites a vote for school student scholarship organizations. There was a vote she had in 2011 that supported more. It was a preliminary vote she cast supporting a provision of that, and Stacey Abrams says that vote means Stacey Evans supported taking money away from public school organizations and bring it to private schools.
I assume what we're talking about when Greg says that, Kyle, is is this the tax credit issue that if I contribute to an educational fund, I can get a tax credit and that money can be used for students in non-public settings?
That's right. It's a tax credit for donating to student scholarship organizations, which award private school scholarships. And it's been around for about 10 years or so. It's a $58 million cap on it that some Republicans have tried to raise a few times over the last few years, unsuccessfully. If I could say from my perspective, the whole taking money away from public schools thing is a real misnomer, in my opinion. This is a program out of the state budget. The K-12 schools get funded on their own. There's never been, like last year when it was proposed to, or this past year when it was proposed to raise the cap, there was no corresponding decrease in the QBE budget to offset this increase in the cap. And the Georgia Supreme Court in their ruling this year recognized you cannot point to a dollar for dollar sort of reduction here. So if I could just on the issue of SSOs more generally say that I think that's a little bit of a misnomer.
Okay, but I've got to say, Theron, this does seem like a good issue for Democrats to be debating. I mean, this sounds like an issue that really is real. It's not made up.
No, not at all. And I think both candidates know that public education and a pathway to making sure that it's well-funded, making sure our students get a first-rate education is something that's going to be very, very pivotal in their success in a Democratic primary. Let's not forget, I mean, Stacey Evans prouds herself of being the person who worked to protect and preserve the Holt Scholarship. So her whole launch around her campaign has been, hey, I want to make sure that I protect education in this state, and also she's talked about free tuition. But what Abrams is attempting to do is say, hey, look at what I've done, look at what my opponent has done. And so to try to cast her as this person who is trying to take away funding for public education is something that I think that Evans' campaign is going to definitely come back strongly on. But it will, again, be one of those center points in
her support for expanding is going to be her hope. Support is one of her premier issues in the Stacey Evans campaign.
It is. I mean, Stacey Evans says she got into the race. The driving factor of her getting in this race was what she calls a betrayal by Stacey Abrams, 5 or 6 years ago, and voting working with Republicans to cobble together that plan that ended up cutting Hope Awards. Mm-hmm. While Stacey Abrams now says Stacey Evans is pushing to quote-unquote privatize education. So the two biggest policy dividing factors in this race both revolve around education.
All right.
What I'd like to do, rather than play a long exchange between them on that, we're going to have plenty of time. We just set the stage for what's going to be a fascinating race to watch. And by the time next Monday rolls around, we'll be able to talk about what Republican candidates said in their first two encounters during the campaign this weekend. Let's look at the Supreme Court and the parallel that's going on here in Georgia. Yesterday, the Supreme Court of the United States heard arguments in a case that involves Wisconsin. There are districts Republicans in Wisconsin, and one of you correct me if I'm not getting this completely right or if I don't give enough detail, Wisconsin Republicans were able to do a redistricting plan that dramatically favored Republican candidates. So even though this is state races, so even though Republicans won, I think, 49% of the vote statewide, they captured more than 60% mm-hmm. of the seats in the state. And this raises this crucial question about whether states' legislatures ought to be allowed to draw lines along partisan boundaries. The court has already said you can't do it along racial lines. And yesterday they heard arguments on this case. And if you listen to the reporters who covered it, there didn't seem to be much disagreement as to whether this looks wrong and is not particularly a good way to draw lines, but the justices cannot seem, at least according, based on the questioning, to agree with whether there's a standard they can agree on that would change this. So let's discuss it.
Like in many cases, Justice Kennedy is the pivotal vote here. And depending on whose analysis you read, it seemed like he seems like he's ready to side with the Democrats in this case. He asked a lot of skeptical questions of the Republican attorneys, and from what I read, no questions at all to the Democratic attorneys. So if this falls upon traditional ideological lines, you could have a monumental court ruling that throws out or at least reestablishes how we draw our district lines right in time for the 2020 census.
Yeah, in almost every way, Theron, I mentioned this on Monday's show, this feels like it is as monumental, if not more so, than Citizens United a few years ago.
Absolutely. And I mean, what gerrymandering and redistricting for partisan purposes does is that it totally undermines our democracy. And I think that, yes, Democrats in Georgia, we did it in 2000, early 2000s, and Republicans are still doing it. I mean, they're actually even trying to do it as of last year before the maps are redrawn. But, you know, John Barrow had a good article in the Washington Post this weekend where he actually went head on with the problem and what exists. So the bottom line is that, listen, we as a nation, we as a country, yes, we need liberal and progressive voices, and yes, we need conservative voices, but the true voices that we need more of, especially in Washington and at a lot of state legislature, is moderate voices. And I think when elected officials get into the business of drawing districts for political gain and political purposes, that eliminates that moderate voice on both sides of the aisle, and therefore you create this gridlock that we're seeing in our government.
But Kyle, it does appear that the justices, as I said, may not understand. What is the standard? What is the line that you draw? How do you mm-hmm. come up with a standard that says, oh, now it's for partisan purposes? What is that point of no return on that?
Well, I'll throw in here that I've given up trying to read the tea leaves from questioning ever since we thought Obamacare was headed for the scrap heap of history based on the questioning in that case, and that certainly didn't turn out that way. I do think that's the key thing. And they can't very well just say, well, this is bad. They have to say, here's the line between appropriate and inappropriate, between legal and illegal, constitutional, unconstitutional. And I've never read a good idea for how that can be drawn on a 50-state basis. I think it's one of those things where those seeking to have this overturned in the courts are trying to accomplish what is meant to be accomplished legislatively and is difficult to accomplish legislatively. I mean, let's be totally honest. I don't know how many states have these commissions to supposed, you know, nonpartisan commissions to draw these up. But it's very few. And so it is doable, though. I mean, it can be done. The people have to decide it's something that they really want to see done, I think. And I would just say there's some question of, you know, the extremes when these districts are lopsided the way they are. But just because you have a bunch of Republicans in a district doesn't mean they're going to be the furthest right-wing group. I mean, we saw in Congressional District 6 earlier this year, you know, that's never, you know, that's somewhat of a moderate Republican district.
Yeah, and that also benefited from Governor Deal wanting to redraw those lines a little bit, maybe to hurt Tom Price,
right?
Because he didn't support Tom Price in 2010. Tom Price didn't support the governor in 2010. But another issue that's coming up in this case, and that's very much playing in Georgia, is the targeted redistricting. this entire state's lines won't be redrawn until 2021. But at least twice, and you know, since the last redrawing, Republicans have done a more targeted redistricting, where they've looked at, they've tried to redistrict. Well, they had redistricted two House districts in 2015 that both narrowly went to the GOP the next year.
And we should make sure, because that's the subject of now a new federal lawsuit filed here in Georgia. In Grayson, Representative Joyce Chandler; in McDonough, Brian Strickland, two Republicans who were very vulnerable in their districts, and so in a special redistricting, the Republican legislature drew more African Americans out of the district and more reliable Republican voters stayed in the district.
And in November, those districts narrowly went to the GOP. And there was another attempt this year that was quickly, that ended up being abandoned, but to redraw the lines for a few more of these districts, especially in northern metro Atlanta, that were starting to get a little purpler.
You know, Theron, we're going to have to take a break in a minute, but the practical effect of this, I think it's fair to say, is it's more than just about whether a Republican or Democrat wins a seat. It's about the nature of debate in our legislative bodies. When people want to know why we are so divided, why people can't get anything done in legislative bodies here or in Washington, part of it is the lines have been drawn in such a dramatically partisan way that no one wants to be in the middle and work with the other side. It has huge impact.
Absolutely. I mean, and therein lies the problem with government. I mean, at a time, let's just set the stage. You know, we have a president that I think every day wakes up in the morning, whether it's on a tweet or through a speech, to try to figure out how he can divide this country, but more particularly, how he can fire up his Republican base. So what that does is that it forces Democrats to not try to be sensible Democrats and moderate Democrats to find a central view. We also have to fire up our base. But you just hit it at its core, Bill. That underlies the problem that at a time where people don't trust government, at a time where Congress has, a less than 20% approval rating, therein lies the problem. And so it really is dependent on, to Kyle's point, political will. Who is going to have the political will to really sit down and come up with a practical solution to this problem that we have in our state?
All right. Well, we'll watch both of those cases progress. And it'll be a while, obviously, before the Supreme Court has anything to say about it. And we'll watch the Georgia case as well. Look, let's get a break out of the way right now, because when we come back, I need to ask Greg Bluestein a question for conversation. Is John Ossoff really coming back in the 6th District to once again take on Karen Handel in 2018? This is Political Rewind.
On the next Fresh Air.
He's too ugly to be the world champ. The world champ should be pretty like me.
We take a new look at Muhammad Ali with Jonathan Eig, author of a new biography of the boxer. The book chronicles Ali's toughest bouts and his sometimes chaotic personal life. Eig is also the author of best-selling books about Al Capone, Jackie Robinson, and the birth of the pill. Join us.
Listen to Fresh Air today at 3 on GPB.
Greg Bluestein, you had a little item the other day that suggested that John Ossoff, who spent $30 million?
He raised $30 million on his own.
To lose. He was kind of teasing people with the notion that he may run against Karen Handel next year again. That shouldn't be a surprise, I suppose. But you think it's going to happen?
Yeah, he hasn't ruled it out since his June 20th defeat by about 4 points to Karen Handel. And recently, he's been teasing a little bit more. He went and spoke over the weekend to the Cobb County Democratic Party, and he went hard after Trump. And this is one of the biggest critiques of his last campaign, was that at the beginning, he was very anti-Trump, and then he sort of moderated his message and talked more about the needs of the district than about the president, even when the president visited the district to campaign for his rival. Well, on Saturday, he called him an incompetent president, a weak and dishonest man on Twitter. And said that if there is ever an opportunity for statesmanship and leadership and unity, he's missing it, essentially.
So we should point out that the reason that it's an election again next year is because Karen Handel won a seat in a special election, which allows her to stay in office until the normal 2018 election comes along and she's got to run again.
And that special election was set up by Tom Price's cabinet appointment, and now...
That's exactly right. $50 million spent
60.
On a 60 on a seat that if Price had only held on to, what the heck, he would still have a public job.
A lot of media consultants are rich right now. Yes, yeah.
And our click base is, our clicks are happy too.
Theron, sure. Theron, after all the national attention, after all the money that poured into the district, I'm going to put you on the spot. Do you think Democrats might be better off to look for a new a new brand to run against Karen Handel. Is Ossoff damaged by the fact that he lost in 2017?
No, because I think what Ossoff did is that he totally changed the game in the way that, hey, there can be a 30-year-old person who's been involved in politics for a long time and policy that comes on the scene at the right time and catches the Trump wave. I think that he's definitely going to run again. I'm not sure for what. But the truth of the matter is this, whether you want John or not, and whether Democrats put up someone else that may fit a different model to go up against Congresswoman Handel, John still has the ability to raise millions and millions of dollars.
He does. You imagine that. Okay.
And let's not forget, he has, I think, the best data. Throughout the loss, one of the bright spots was that he was able to collect, capture a lot of data in that district. So I think he has an advantage if he decides to run.
You know, Kyle, it does strike me that Karen Handel, now an incumbent who's going to have to start running again, is suddenly a Republican member of a Congress that, for the most part, is rubber stamping President Trump's agenda when they get a chance, when there is an agenda to rubber stamp. And that could put her on the defensive in a district that is increasingly a swing district.
Well, the one benefit of the doubt, I would give Karen Handel on that is she dealt with that the whole first time around as well.
Yeah, but she wasn't an incumbent. She didn't have to cast votes.
But she was basically made to answer for the Republicans in Congress as if she were an incumbent. So I'm a little skeptical of that. I'm a little – Theron is better positioned than I am to know what Democrats nationally are going to do. I've been operating on the assumption that having spent that much money one go-around and having so many other things that they need to concentrate on in 2018, like – trying to retake the U.S. House. I mean, this can be a part of that, of course, but so many Senate seats to defend. Yeah. Is there a high priority for Democrats outside of Georgia, which is where the vast, vast majority of John Ossoff's money came, to spend on that again versus a governor's race here or, you know, Senate races elsewhere? That's been my operating assumption, that that's a tough sell.
Yeah, listen, two things over certain. Number one, John Ossoff will not raise $30 million again if he runs. And the other certain thing, and if he's listening, anyone knows him, move in the district now.
Yeah, for those people who don't remember, Ossoff was hit hard over and over, and I think, Greg, you covered that race. It was a legitimately tough issue for him to deal with that he doesn't live in the district.
It was, and it was one that continued to dog him through the campaign, and one that Karen Handel said after, on June 21st, when I asked her what do you think one of the deciding factors was, and she said, you know, and even though it didn't show up in the polls as much as she thought it would, that when voters in Milton and in Roswell and in East Cobb would come up to her, they'd invariably say something about how he didn't live in the district. So it was something that helped energize Republicans.
All right, we're going to move on. But before we do, does everybody agree that the 6th District let me say it a different way. Will the 6th District be competitive in 2018? Everybody agree or you disagree?
Absolutely, it will be.
I think if a candidate like John Ossoff gets in, it will be.
Certainly more competitive than it's been in the past. Will it be more? Will the margin be as close or closer than it was in the runoff? I don't know.
You know, this is a race we need to add to the list of things we talk about on this show. So let's hope it's really competitive.
It'll be more competitive than most of the races in this state.
Yeah,
I'll say
that's
that.
For sure. Yeah. All right, let's. President Trump visited Puerto Rico yesterday, and most people who listen to this show are glued to political news, so you all have seen the way he comported himself yesterday. Kyle, let me start with you, because you're the conservative columnist, for the AJC. The president made statements, that, as you're well aware of, yesterday, and took actions, the throwing of paper towels out to people who were waiting to see him, statements essentially congratulating the people of Puerto Rico because there weren't as many deaths there as in Katrina. There was a whole series of things, which many people suggest shows a lack of some kind of sensitivity or humanity. Is there? Or is this the anti-Trump folks always looking for some reason to criticize him?
Can I say yes to both? I mean, look, there's a reason the anti-Trump folks always have material to work with, right? I mean, it's not really a good look for the president of the United States going to an island like Puerto Rico that's been devastated by this hurricane and throwing rolls of paper towels out into the crowd. The story about Tom Price, and, you know, he said he didn't like the optics and everything. Boy, you would talk about bad optics. He's constantly producing them for himself. I mean, if that's the standard in this administration, then there's a lot of firings that need to happen, and they need to go way up the chain. I'm not going to defend what he said or did yesterday. So,
Taryn?
It was disgraceful. I mean, let me just go there. I mean, to go over to a country that, quite frankly, was hit, I think, the worst out of all the islands that were hit, and the lack of response to it, and the moment when he could have actually went there for assistance, like he did in Houston and other places in Florida, but to take that moment where he could have been a leader and criticize NFL players and call them SOBs, and then when he has the opportunity again, to Kyle's point, to be presidential, to say, you know what, I'm going to turn the page. I'm going to make a believer out of all these millions of people who voted for me to assume this job of president of the United States. To actually take a paper towel roll and treat it like it's a basketball and toss it to people who are just hopeless right now, without any water, without any means to a next phase in their life, just shows how this guy is just unhinged. He's just disrespectful. And I agree with John Ossoff. I think that every moment he has an opportunity to show leadership and to bring this country together, he does the exact opposite.
Greg, it's troubling, among other things, because these are these opportunities for a country to come together. He's in Las Vegas, and as I said at the beginning of the show, we've been told by White House Press Corps that he intends to stay very closely to a script. He is going to spend time with victims. So this is another chance for him to exhibit a certain kind of humanity, a caring. But every one of these things are an opportunity for all of us to feel, as a country, we can come together. And instead, we're kind of left with this sense that we don't have any center. We don't know how to moor ourselves around these things.
And we've seen flashes of it. I think Democrats and Republicans on Monday doing his presidential address after the shootings, both applauded the tone and the message he gave. And then a lot of people were let down hours later, days later, on Twitter when he takes an opposite tone. So I think it's very jarring for the American people just to go back and forth like a ping pong ball almost.
The other issue that comes up as a result of this is this notion of fake news. The president's been on Twitter again this morning bashing particularly NBC for coverage of Puerto Rico, which the president says is distorted. Distorted doesn't show us a true picture of what's going on there. And this is a bizarre kind of situation because, for the most part, yeah, we've seen some video, certainly, but we can't be there. And to some extent, there's kind of a curtain around Puerto Rico that Trump can exploit to suggest that a news organization is only going to the most devastated areas, not looking at the whole island. And this, again, raises the issue. He's allowed to raise issues about the credibility of the media, right?
Well, he was also going after NBC today for its reports about Secretary of State Rex Tillerson and comments that he allegedly made, calling the president in private a moron and saying that he had reporting that he had threatened to resign over the summer.
In July, yeah.
Right. And so Tillerson gave a press conference today which basically amounted to refuting the NBC story. And so I have to think that
you're right.
It's all sort of wrapped up together.
You're right. Tillerson didn't actually deny the NBC report, but he certainly deflected it.
He denied the part about threatening to resign.
And later on, actually,
not the moron part.
But he did not explicitly deny that.
And since we've been on air, he actually has, his office now put out a statement saying he did deny saying the moron part.
I just find it's almost like Richard Nixon, I'm not a crook. It's Rex Tillerson, no, the president is not a moron.
he said he was a very smart person, I believe. Yes.
All right, look, I want to, we're going to stop the conversation here because I do want to take just a couple of minutes that we have left to tell you about an unfolding story in the Political Rewind family of panelists. You all have heard Todd Rehm on this show many, many times in the last few years. A little more than a year ago, just over a year ago, his wife, Stephanie, was diagnosed with ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease. For a very long time, Todd was silent about that. He did not want people to be aware of it. And recently, as Stephanie's condition has continued to get worse, he's decided it's time for him to let people know what they're dealing with. Todd actually was going to be here today and couldn't, because at this stage he's looking at how he's going to find someone who can be there in a hospice care situation. So our thoughts are with him continually through this. They're a wonderful couple. Todd is a smart, terrific guy, and watching him deal with this has been really so sad for all of us. And I mention it in part today because Todd finally said, please do, but also because there's a big ALS walk in Atlanta this weekend. And if you want to be a part of that walk, or if you want to help people, if you listen to this show and have heard Todd and care about him, if you understand what a difficult disease is, ALS is. Todd himself has a team. It's toddwalks.com, and, you know, he would love to have you be a part of that. Whether you want to do Todd's team or not, ALS is such a devastating, incurable condition. And so we just, because it's a member of our family, wanted to send our thoughts out to Todd, and also say think about the ALS walk and how you might want to participate. Anybody else want to say? We've got enough time for one word on this, really.
No, I'll just say, listen, Todd is a wonderful man, and you know, he privately has talked a lot about his love for his wife, yep, and his commitment to her. So I just definitely pray for him and Stephanie, and hope that she is able to pull through this as best as you can.
Thank you, Theron. All right, Greg Bluestein, Theron Johnson, Kyle Wingfield, thank you so much for a terrific conversation today on Political Rewind. Tom Barclay, our operations manager at the command center, running the board while Tyler Morris is off on vacation in some far-flung corner of the world. Thank you very much, Tom. Our associate producer, Olivia Rheingold, thank you for your work today. And our new producer, who we introduced everybody on Monday, Tom Faust, is in there taking over, and I'll soon be doing whatever he tells me to do. I'm Bill Nygut. We're done today. We'll be back on Friday with a brand new show. Hope you can join us then. Tomorrow, Political Rewind, we'll talk about the only municipality north of the Mason-Dixon line to have seceded from the Union back in 1861. Our guest is Darren Wong, author of a new novel that recounts that story. That's Two-Way Street tomorrow at 2, Political Rewind Friday at 3. See you for all of that.